From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last night on the streets of Rochester. Protesters chanted many familiar refrains, "No justice, no peace," for example. But there was one theme that was relatively new and sometimes misunderstood. Some of the demonstrators called for an end to qualified immunity for police officers. What is qualified immunity? Even before the announcement on Tuesday that no Rochester police officers would face criminal charges for the death of Daniel Prude, the Monroe County Bar Association had already planned a public event to address this kind of issue. They're pulling together a panel of legal experts to explain all sides to qualified immunity and liability, both criminal and civil, for police officers. Last summer, following the killing of George Floyd, Congressman Justin Amash was the first in Congress last year to call for ending qualified immunity on a national level. But as we've seen, this issue can be handled at various levels of government. Last year, Colorado stepped in and quickly found out how volatile this issue of police liability can be. I'll quote the Marshall Project now. Quote, "Colorado police officers who violate people's civil rights can now be held personally responsible in state court, and they can't use the defense that experts say has stymied many efforts to hold police accountable, qualified immunity. It's a legal doctrine that says government workers can't be held liable for what they do on the job, except in rare circumstances. Some legal experts are praising the new law. Colorado has passed what is, for the moment, the gold standard reform," said Robert McNamara, a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, which is a libertarian nonprofit. "These laws are changing the status quo as to when there are consequences for bad behavior," he said. "But the change is drawing fire from police unions, which say qualified immunity is essential to protect their members from being sued just for doing their jobs, and from some local governments, which fear it will hurt their abilities to recruit and keep officers," end quote. That's just one state. There are questions about qualified immunity. There is opposition from police just about everywhere. Officers tend to argue that if they're afraid to do their job fully as trained, even in potentially dangerous circumstances, if they're worried about getting sued, then their own lives or the lives of the public could be at risk. And they argue that officers should not have to fear getting sued for making an honest mistake. Of course, the counterpoint is that qualified immunity is a shield that covers much more than just honest mistakes. So let's talk about all of this. And our guests this hour are joining us today on Connections, but also want to let you know that part of continuing legal education, the Monroe County Bar Association has an event tomorrow, starting at 5, going to 6:30 p.m. It's on Zoom, and we'll make sure you've got all the information so you can check out this panel of experts exploring the legal issues relating to criminal and civil liability of law enforcement in the discharge of their duties. Joining us this hour is the moderator of tomorrow's event. That's attorney at law Anna Marie Richmond, who's with us. Anna Marie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Evan, so much.
Also with us, James Nobles, a partner with Nobles and DeCarlis. James, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Evan. A pleasure to be here.
Stephen Schwarz is with us, managing partner with Faraci Lang. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Dwayne Basco is an attorney with Abrams Fensterman. Dwayne, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What I want to mention right off the top here is at least one of our guests, we should probably talk a little bit with Stephen Schwarz about the fact that I know you've worked with the Prude family. Can you tell us a little bit about your role there? We'll start there, Stephen.
Yeah, I'm part of a legal team that's representing Nathaniel McFarland. He is the estate representative of Daniel Prude, and we will be handling the civil case brought in federal court against the city of Rochester and the police officers.
Okay. So I think it's valuable just to ask Anna Marie Richmond right off the top as the moderator tomorrow. What do you hope the public will get out of this event exploring this issue that is very much a complex issue?
I think that our goal is to help people understand why the issue is complex, what the complexities are, why you can't jump to conclusions about how things are going to work, and to provide resources for people. The target audience is two groups: lawyers who may be litigating these cases and members of the public. So with respect to attorneys, provide resources that will enable them to hone their skills with respect to the issues that arise in these cases. And with regard to members of the public, to provide hopefully an introductory education and the ability to give them information about where else they can go to do research.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask our guests if we could. Well, I should also say, Anna Marie, our guests on the program today, participating tomorrow, but we don't have all of the participants. I know you wanted to mention that.
Yeah, Mr. Schwartz and Mr. Nobles are part of the panel. The other two members of the panel, and we're very excited about this, are two additional attorneys, both of whom are from out of town. Frederick Brewington is an attorney from Hempstead, New York, who has built a law practice on providing representation of people whose civil rights are being violated. He has litigated a lot of police brutality cases, and he's going to focus in the presentation on key considerations for people who are representing plaintiffs in those cases. And I've seen his written materials. They're really interesting and somewhat disturbing, and I think people are going to get a lot out of that. Our other person who's not here is John Elmore, who's an attorney from Buffalo. And Mr. Elmore has a really interesting background. Before he went to law school, he was a New York State police officer. He worked as a prosecutor. He worked as a criminal defense attorney. And at this point, he works in a private practice in which he does plaintiff's litigation. Mr. Elmore's focus is going to be, he's from Buffalo, his focus is going to be on a lot of policy-related issues, changes in litigation concerning how police officers function, work that's being done in Buffalo through the Minority Bar Association of Western New York. He's a member of the Criminal Justice Task Force there, and the changes that are happening here. And I think both he and Mr. Brewington are going to bring a perspective and an information to Rochester that's going to be very valuable to people.
Well, let me ask our guests for their opening thoughts on how you simply describe what qualified immunity is, first of all. And James Nobles, let me start with you. How do you describe what qualified immunity is?
You know, I think, actually, Evan, I'm not trying to dodge the question, but I'm probably the least qualified person to answer it. My involvement in this panel is simply as a criminal defense attorney talking about sort of the background of how cases are differently brought against police officers than they are regular citizens as it relates to that. So, you know, I have some general law school knowledge on qualified immunity, but I'm certain that my co-panelist can explain it in a much more eloquent way than I can.
Can I ask you then maybe something related before
sure.
I turn to them?
Go ahead.
Just trying to summarize some of the public discourse, especially going back to June of last year when Congressman Amash came out with his comments on qualified immunity. You see members of Congress talking about it on down to local governments. I mentioned Colorado at the outset. There's an idea that, well, you can't sue a cop, that there's a special shield of protection and that if they do wrong, they're protected in the way that you and I would not be. Is that too broad, or do you think that there is something to that?
No, I don't think that's too broad, but I think it's actually broader than that, because this idea of qualified immunity, as best I understand it, also applies to, you know, other government employees, whether that's, you know, the Department of Public Works or the Highway Department or a variety of different areas. So there's qualified immunity in a variety of governmental bodies and agencies well beyond police departments.
Is there a logic to you to it?
It's very historical. I took a class in law school on this. What was basically my paraphrasing of the title was suing the government. And, you know, what I recall from that was, you know, you can't sue the government unless they allow you to sue them for a particular area. So, for instance, you know, most government entities have said if one of our employees is at fault in a car accident, you can sue us. I don't know that there is or there isn't. I think, as I recall, one of the reasons that was said for this policy was that it sort of protects the taxpayers against huge judgments and different things that may come from it. But, you know, again, I'm probably not the most qualified person to talk about qualified immunity.
Well, Stephen Schwartz, how do you describe what qualified immunity is?
Well, I think you have to look at the context of the case. It's a common law doctrine that is not encompassed in the civil rights statutes. It was actually adopted by the Supreme Court over time because they determined that Congress could not have intended to eliminate all immunities. So there are basically two kinds of immunities. There's absolute immunity and there's qualified immunity. Absolute immunity applies to a limited set of people, judges, prosecutors, and certain others that are in a judicial or quasi-judicial role, and those people cannot be sued. So no matter what happens in a courtroom with a judge or a prosecutor in the course of their doing their jobs, they can't be sued for any constitutional violations. Qualified immunity applies to every other entity or person that's sued let me say, person that sued. The Civil Rights Statute, 1983, which again came out of the Reconstruction Ku Klux Klan Act, applies to persons acting under color of state law, depriving others of their constitutional rights. So police officers and other and as Jim said, virtually any governmental official that deprives someone of constitutional rights has an entitlement to claim qualified immunity. Now, it's an objective standard, qualified immunity. So what the standard is they have to prove that they acted in good faith without an understanding that what they were doing was depriving someone of their constitutional rights. And there are some cases, for instance, where a constitutional right was only recently recognized by the Supreme Court, where they held that it wasn't reasonable for these officials to understand that the law had changed on a particular aspect. But when it comes to excessive use of force, it's not as easy to make a claim that objectively you didn't understand that you were violating someone's constitutional rights. So, the qualified immunity doctrine, again, goes back to England and has been with us for a long time and was applied to the civil rights statutes, and it applies an objective standard. And there are times, obviously, that the jury can be persuaded that objective standard is met and that the police officers or whatever government entities, officials are claiming that they acted in good faith, and the jury can believe that, and that can be an impediment to recovery. The one thing I'll mention too is the Supreme Court in a case called Owens back in probably 40 years ago now determined that municipalities are not entitled to qualified immunity. So originally the Supreme Court had ruled that municipalities couldn't be sued under the Civil Rights Statute. That was changed in a case called Monell. And after that, then, in a case called Owen, they determined that the immunities that are given to individual officers of the state or of municipalities, those immunities didn't apply to a municipality. The catch there is, though, that you have to be able to prove that the constitutional deprivation was an act of policy by the municipality. In other words, it was either a statutory thing or it was a common practice that was followed by the entire municipality. That's probably more than you wanted to know, Evan.
Well, no, that's okay. And Steve, I'll ask you what I'm asking the other guests. I mean, do you see a logic to it? And do you understand maybe the growing public view that qualified immunity makes it too difficult or nigh impossible to sue a police officer or hold them accountable?
Well, it's not impossible. I think that there are numerous cases, and including the one we're handling, that we think it's more than possible. But it does make it more difficult, and it's a doctrine, though, that if you look at it from the standpoint of how it was intended, obviously, if someone's doing their job in a way in that they can establish was in good faith, and someone is injured or their rights are injured as a result of that, but they acted in good faith, then you could say, yes, that makes a lot of sense. The issue is really whether that's abused and whether juries understand it and whether there might be some statutory tinkering with that to make it clearer what is really meant by that immunity. And I think that is the effort that's being discussed now.
Well, and just to make sure our listeners understand then, you feel that the standard can be high, but it is not unmeetable, and that the next steps, at least for the Prude family estate, are what? You're turning to a civil action?
Yeah, the civil action has been filed. We were substituted in. There was an issue with regard to the representation of the estate, but we will be filing an amended complaint shortly, and that litigation is about to begin.
Okay, and this is where I forgive my utter ignorance. I'm the son of an attorney, guys, and I'm really just worthless. That's why you're all here. So forgive me on this, Steve, but is there any more challenging hurdle for your team to clear, given the fact that, based on what the AG said yesterday, they presented the strongest case they could, at least on the criminal side, and got nowhere with a grand jury? Does that factor, or are you sort of starting over on the civil side and working on your case there?
Well, Evan, I think you have to understand that the difference between civil and criminal law is vast.
Sure, sure.
And Jim can speak to that. For a crime to be committed, there's an intent requirement that has to be met. And for a civil action, there really is not the same intent. You know, there can be negligence where you do something recklessly or carelessly that causes someone injury. And so it's a very different standard. There's also a different standard of proof beyond reasonable doubt versus a preponderance of the evidence. So the civil case is going to be much different and have different standards and not have a grand jury process, but actually have a litigation process where obviously the city and the officers are absolutely entitled to try to get the case dismissed. But that would be before a judge under very different standards than a grand jury would operate under.
What's the timeline on that case?
Well, we're just getting started, so I think it's going to nothing in the law moves quickly. So I would expect it's going to take us some time to gather the necessary information. The discovery process is very broad in federal court, and we anticipate that in addition to the vast amount of information that's public, there's going to be a lot more that's going to be discovered. So,
okay.
So it'll be a while.
Dwayne Basco, how do you view, you know, sort of a simple answer of how you view qualified immunity and maybe how you answer that to the lay public?
Well, I think Steve did a deep dive into the definition of qualified immunity. I would like to probably talk more about the fact that even though Steve indicated that it's a high bar, that it's still reachable, and I think we get into the facto versus de jure when it comes to meeting that standard, which is why the reform that it's suggested in the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act of 2020, the proposed bill seeks to eliminate qualified immunity by stating that it shall not be a defense or immunity in any action brought under this section against a local law enforcement officer or in any action under any source of law against a federal investigative or law enforcement officer that the defendant was acting in good faith or that the defendant believed, reasonably or otherwise, that his or her conduct was lawful at the time the conduct was committed. I think because the fact that there are the technical aspect of it, that standard can be reached, it oftentimes is not reached due to de facto reasons. And that's something that the crowds are really excited about as far as trying to get the qualified immunity standard lowered.
Can I, if I could, I think what I'd like to do is just read a little bit written even before last summer. This goes back to 2018 in the pages of National Review, written by a conservative attorney named David French, who wrote a piece titled End Qualified Immunity Now. And I guess I want to ask our guests if they view these kinds of cases as pertinent to the discourse. Because David French did, and this is the case that he's trying to make is that these kinds of incidents illustrate the problem with qualified immunity. So he writes the following, quote, "In the early morning hours of July 15th, 2012, a young man named Andrew Scott was up late, home with his girlfriend. They were playing video games when they heard a loud pounding on their door. Alarmed, Scott grabbed a pistol and opened the door. He saw a man crouching outside in the darkness. Scott retreated, the gun still at his side, pointing down to the ground. Almost instantly, the crouching figure fired his own weapon. The encounter was over in 2 seconds. Scott was on the ground, dead. And the man who fired? He was a police officer. He was at the wrong house. Andrew Scott was a completely innocent man who had done nothing more than exercise his constitutional right to keep and bear arms in defense of his own home. As for the police officer, well, not only was he at the wrong house, but he had no search warrant even for the correct house. He had not turned on his emergency lights, and he did not identify himself as police when he knocked on the door. The officer was never prosecuted. The state ruled that the shooting was justified, in part because it said the police had no obligation to identify themselves. Then, when Scott's estate sued the officer for money damages, the court threw out the lawsuit. A panel from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the dismissal. A police officer killed an innocent man because of the officer's inexcusable mistake. He escaped criminal prosecution, and then he even escaped civil liability because of a little-known, judge-made legal doctrine called qualified immunity. And it's time to end it. End quote. That's from conservative attorney David French, writing for National Review in 2018. Stephen Schwartz, is that a fair case to point to say I've got a problem with this and here's why?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's a horrific result. And based upon the facts that you've relayed, that seems to me a very unjust result. So absolutely, if the court, and I haven't read that decision, so I can't I can't explain precisely what the 11th Circuit had in mind, but I was kind of surprised when you got to that point to hear that that was affirmed, because that does not seem to me to be a good faith exercise of the duties of the police officer. Obviously, there were mistakes made all along the line. So the concept, again, the Civil Rights Act wasn't necessarily limited to intentional acts. And I think that's the problem. In other words, if the argument is that that officer didn't intend to kill that innocent person, it just happened, then all of the negligence and the recklessness that went along with that has to be considered, regardless of whether he intended it or not.
Right. And Steve, this is where I think someone like David French is arguing that, contrary to your contention that, for example, in the Prude family estate case, that you feel like you've got a good case to make, that it's a high bar, but you can clear it. David French is arguing that qualified immunity has become so all-encompassing that it is almost impossible to win these kinds of cases, even when you've got a case like the one I just described that he wrote about that seemed to grab the public's eyes and say, well, of course this is wrong. Of course this is negligent. Of course this demands accountability. French is saying we've lost the chance to do that now. It seems that you don't quite get that far as he does, Steve.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think that I'm dealing with the law as it exists today, and I certainly would advocate that those restrictions be limited. I mean, I think that, again, there are certain circumstances where I can see that there's some good faith immunity should be applied, but that wouldn't be one of them. So, again, if the doctrine is being applied in that way, then no, I don't agree with it, and I think it's being misapplied in honesty. So my thought would be that there should be some middle ground and that there should be some immunity, but it's got to be much more limited than would apply in a case like that where someone was certainly killed because of somebody else's fault without any question. And if there's no recourse there, then I could never agree with that.
Hmm. Attorney Duane Basco, what do you make of the story there relayed by David French in National Review? I mean, is that sensationalistic, or does that sort of exemplify a potential problem that is maybe not, we're not seeing that every day, but we see it enough to rise to the level of a problem?
I would say it's a same book, different chapter. I'm going to it's funny that you would read that story because here's another story out of Portland, Oregon. When three police officers came to the house to search the premises, they had no warrant, failed to identify themselves as officers. The occupants of the house, believing that they were burglars, defended themselves. One officer entered the rear of the house, shot the occupant with a shotgun, and no charges were filed. This is a 1945 case of Irvin Jones. This is a part of the presentation that was brought before the UN when the United States was brought up on genocide charges in 1951. So when you say qualified immunity, it's a different name for the same results, not to hold people accountable for their actions. Hmm. So it's not hyperbolic and it's not reaching.
Okay. James Nobles, any thoughts on the case I just relayed?
Yeah, I would agree with what both of the gentlemen said. I mean, obviously there are absolutely times where citizens should be able to sue government officials, whether it's police officers or others. And certainly the story that you relayed, Evan, as well as my co-panelists just a moment ago, are absolutely examples of where people should be able to bring charges like they would against any other member of the community.
Anna Marie Richmond, anything you want to add there?
I don't think I have anything to add to what any of the gentlemen said, no.
Can I ask some of the panelists then to at least, this question is harder, I think, for our guests to address because it's not necessarily a legal perspective, but one of the defenses of qualified immunity sounds something like this. If I'm a police officer, I have to be able to do a stressful, difficult job, sometimes in dangerous circumstances, without fear that any mistake at all could cost me my livelihood, could cost my family, that if I'm always thinking twice about every little thing, I'm not going to be able to trust my training, I'm not going to be able to react quickly and appropriately, my life could be at risk, members of the public could be at risk. And qualified immunity is a way of saying that there is a special standard for policing, that we respect that, and we're not going to sort of nitpick how you do your job in a way that could endanger you or make you feel less comfortable doing your job. So I'll start with James Nobles. I mean, that's not a legal argument. I mean, that's sort of a psychological one, but we do hear that. And I guess I'm curious to know if you think that there is, if there's some merit or valid concern there.
I mean, I think, everything is on a spectrum, I would say. Mm-hmm. And that example fits into that statement completely. You know, I think, when we're hearing about, officers who aren't identified as police officers who storm a house and, people don't know who they are and they shoot them, that obviously is beyond the level of, hey, I made a mistake doing my job. But I think the argument is a little bit disingenuous, and I'm not picking on you for making it, Evan, but I know it's probably not yours originally, but the reality is that these officers, whether or not they have found to have done something negligent or something culpable as it relates to any kind of a civil lawsuit, the money doesn't come out of their pockets. The money's coming from the city or the county or the town that employs those people, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're terminated from their employment. But, I think we would say in any other profession, if you make a big enough mistake, you certainly can be terminated from your employment, and I think people see that with good cause. So, I think that's on a spectrum, and, there is a basis for that argument on one hand, but there's certainly we can come up with numerous examples of where, we can that argument goes to its absurd conclusion when we talk about some of these, factual recitations that we're having here about things that have actually happened. Certainly there shouldn't be that much protection.
Okay. Dwayne Basco, what do you think? Might be on mute, Dwayne. Oh, there you are. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. There we go. All right. I think that the calculus of reasonableness that is being used in that situation, stating that they have to make a split-second judgment in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and dangerous and rapidly evolving, I think it's a catch-22 because if that is your training, if these are circumstances that you come under fire on, then there has to be a level of expectations of normalcy in that situation. However atypical it is to any other individual that is not in that profession, there should be some normalcy as far as your daily encounters that leads you to be held to a higher standard, not a lower standard, stating that, well, this is a split-second decision, so I have to make this decision and I shouldn't be judged by that. If this is something that's common to the practice, like my other panelist was saying, that and doctors, lawyers, things of that nature, if you're judged by common to the practice, then you're held to a higher standard. It's not seen as an excuse to get out of irrational behavior.
Steve Schwartz, what do you make of this issue, this particular argument?
Well, I think, again, I think there's a couple of different parts to that. For instance, the Breonna Taylor situation, which is similar to the situation that you described, mm-hmm. in the police storming a house and killing the wrong person. And that was the no-knock warrant situation where, in other words, there are policies that I think can be changed that would restrict the putting police officers in that position, which is one part. I think that that definitely needs to be done. There have to be more more restrictions on creating situations like that. And I think that that is in the works as far as being discussed anyway. But the other part of the whole police situation that I think is the bigger part is differentiating sort of the good faith mistakes from the systemic racism that is unfortunately still so prevalent in so many police departments. And it's not only systemic racism, but it's also the concept that police officers are not comfortable in any way from basically testifying against their compatriots, because they will be ostracized as a result of that. And going way back, I had a case back in the 80s where somebody got beat up on a city front lawn that was, 25 by 20. There were 8 police officers there and multiple other people, and 7 of the police officers saw nothing. The neighbors saw everything, but I could not get any, all of them claimed they didn't see the attack occur. And I think, again, I understand that. I think that it's natural in that, in the police community to not want to testify against your compatriots. But I think that until we deal with that, it's very difficult to get at the truth. And it's also very difficult for police departments to get rid of people who shouldn't be police officers. And that is something that we have to address somehow, some way. And systemic racism plays into that as well, because of some of the people that are hired to be police officers. And it's unfortunate, because there's so many great police officers and so many officers that want to do the right thing, but they're very much handcuffed, I think, by that culture.
Yeah, and I intended to take break, the only break of the hour now, but let me just kind of follow up that point with our guest that Steve is making. Steve's the managing partner with Faraci Lang. If that construction is true, if it is true that it is very difficult to get active duty, currently employed police officers to testify against their colleagues, to speak out against them, and I think that's probably a fair observation to make. I mean, it was hard for me to get current police and law enforcement to speak ill of the officers in the Philando Castile case, and that's several states away, several years ago. So, I mean, I understand the point that Steve's making. If that is true, Steve, do you see remedy? What starts to change that, Steve?
Well, I think, it has to start from the top, not to belittle unions, because unions do a great job in a lot of ways, but I think the unions can play into that by feeling that they need to protect everyone that's in the union, regardless of their activities and regardless of how bad their actions were. But I think, there are laws that we have on the books for doctors, for instance, who are required to report certain things that they see in the emergency department if they believe there's been child abuse. And we may have to have something like that, have a legal duty on police officers to report things so that they can freely report them without being, ostracized as a snitch.
Dwayne Basco, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the wall of blue has to come down. The blue wall of silence has to come down. There are officers that I've spoken with that are fearful of retaliation, not being able to get back up if they don't toe the line. And there is a severe lack of accountability in that form, as well as transparency, as seen by the repeal of 50A that is still being fought out in the courts right now, where disciplinary records are not being provided upon request. So top down, yes. Making officers feel more secure when they do want to come forward, and also transparency. And I think those three things have to be policies that have to be addressed.
James Nobles?
I don't have anything to add to what the panelists said.
Okay, fair enough. Anna Marie Richmond, I should say.
Yes, and in addition to top down from within the law enforcement agencies, there's also legislative change that's possible. Buffalo recently passed an ordinance requiring police officers to intervene where they see another officer violating someone's rights. It's called Cariol's Law. It arises out of an incident that occurred several years ago in this city where a female officer tried to stop one of her colleagues from harming somebody and violating their rights. She ended up being fired shortly before she qualified for her pension. The law as passed imposes an obligation on police officers to ensure that they don't stand blindly and quietly by when their fellows are violating someone's rights, and impose liability on the officers who fail to intervene when they should. I think that to focus only on qualified immunity as the problem with holding people accountable for misconduct is too narrow. And I think that the issue has to be a systemic change in the way we think about policing and the way we think about law enforcement. I think Steve's absolutely on the mark when he talks about systemic racism. I think that it's not just in our police agencies. It's pervasive in our culture. And I think it's critical that we consider who are the people who are being harmed most by these police and other governmental sources of systemic racism, and we look for ways to modify our entire paradigm so that people are being treated equally and fairly, and so that the obligations of police officers to protect and serve are the ones that take precedence. And when you're talking about protecting and serving the public, not protecting and serving folks who have violated people's rights.
You're hearing Anna Marie Richmond, attorney at law, and Anna Marie is the moderator of an event tomorrow. The event from 5 to 6:30 on Zoom, and we'll make sure if you want to check it out, we've got you linked up on our various platforms. It's the Monroe County Bar Association putting on a forum titled Law Enforcement and Legal Immunity, Exploring a Complex Problem from All Sides. So Anna Marie will be part of that, and also part of that will be James Nobles, who is a partner with Nobles and DeCarlis, and Stephen Schwarz, who is a partner with Farachi Lang. Dwayne Basco is with us, an attorney with Abrams Fensterman. And we've got some of your questions after this, our only break of the hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, President Biden has said he wants to strengthen the Affordable Care Act, build on the foundation that is already there. But many in his own party want to see single payer. And if it doesn't happen federally, a group says it's time for New York State to pursue single-payer health care. In our second hour, a conversation with members of the state delegation, State Senator Jeremy Cooney, Assemblyman Damon Meeks. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Jillian writes to say, is there a rep from police on this panel? Doesn't seem like it, and if not, why not? And will they be represented in tomorrow night's Zoom event? That's from Jillian. Jillian, I'll just tell you briefly, all four slots, I worked with Rick Dollinger to help fill them. As intimidating as Rick seems on the outside, he's actually got a soft inner shell, and he's actually he'd be happy to work with whatever we wanted to do here. But I did tell Rick and the team from the Monroe County Bar Association that we wanted to kind of cede the floor and allow them to put together a panel of legal experts to talk about this issue on Connections tomorrow night. Anna Marie Richmond, Jillian wants to know if there is anyone from police who's going to be joining. And Anna Marie, I can't hear you if you're there. It might be on
I'm sorry, I was okay. Muted. I think Mr. Nobles fills that role. As I understand it, and I'm not a Rochester litigator, that he represents police officers on a regular basis.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. James Nobles?
Yeah, that is. I represented one of the police officers in the AG's investigation and regularly represent members of the Locust Club and other local law enforcement agencies if they are unfortunately charged with a crime.
Okay. Now, I think it's healthy to hear different points of view. And James, I understand, if you don't want to touch it further, but to the point Steve was making, and this is not the first time you hear this, one of the complaints you hear of unions generally, but also police unions, is that there is nobody that they wouldn't defend. Is that your experience, James, or do you feel like it's more nuanced than that?
I think one of the things that's an issue, Evan, that, could be looked at, and I don't want to speak for the union because I'm not intimately involved in the negotiations or any of that. But you know, the reality is they have a contractual obligation to defend their members if they were working at the time of the alleged incident. So, you know, that is part of what the union has negotiated. It's part of what the union members pay for. They have a legal defense fund that, you know, I don't know what percentage, but a certain percentage of every week's or month's dues go into. So they do have a, you know, an obligation to counsel and or defend their members. That being said, I can tell you that, you know, like any other case, there are often times in which the union looks at allegations, whether they're criminal or just departmental, violations of departmental rules, and they counsel their members that they should take some sort of disposition or some sort of plea. And sometimes that even, you know, involves them losing their job. So, you know, I would say that they have an obligation to defend every member, but the level of defense changes depending on, you know, the allegations, the member, you know, what the department and or the union feel about the situation. So it really is just like any other case, except that they have an obligation to at least give these people some counseling or defense. But sometimes that counseling is, you know, you better cut your losses and take whatever it is they're offering you.
All right, back to email. Martin says, officers are increasingly refusing to identify themselves in public. How can we seek to hold anyone accountable if they won't identify themselves? So before I turn to the panel for thoughts on officers identifying themselves, I'm reading a release from the Minority Bar Association of Western New York, and this is, you know, I'm not sure all of the catalyst for this release from the Minority Bar Association, but they addressed this late last year. Could be because they're targeting Buffalo and Buffalo as a department specifically, which could be because during protests there were some incidents and engagements with civilians.
I can actually address.
Yeah,
this.
Yeah, Anna Maria, please
sorry
do.
To interrupt.
Yeah, please do.
That came out in the wake of a departmental policy announced by the Buffalo Police. That going forward, the police officers were not going to be required to wear name tags. They would only need to display their badge numbers. And there was a notion or reports that I can't remember what the current lingo is, but that officers were being identified on social media and then being harassed on social media. The Minority Bar Association and its criminal justice task force, along with the Bar Association of Erie County, which is the association of which all lawyers are members, has both strongly come out in favor of a Buffalo Right to Know law, which not only requires officers to wear name tags that display their identity, but also to provide people involved in encounters with the police that do not result in an arrest to receive a calling card from the police identifying who the officer was, what the reason for the interaction was, and what the result was. So this is an effort to ensure that police officers are, in fact, identifying themselves in their encounters with the public.
Yeah, and I'll just read a little bit from the Minority Bar Association's release. They write, it is recommended that all officers of the Buffalo Police Department be required to display both a name tag and a badge number on their uniform for identification purposes. And they list four reasons for putting the public statement out, including they think the public was essentially circumvented in this policy, which was done impromptu, done quickly without input, and done without many considerations. So, Anna Marie, just to kind of close the loop on this point there, that's a Buffalo story, but that's also a story in Rochester when people in protest movements are concerned that there's no identifying information. Or I've seen it in Memphis, I've seen it in New York City. Should there be a consistent standard here, and is the release from the Minority Bar Association logical to you?
I think it's very logical, and one of the things that I think is really important about this is that although all of these problems are local, none of them are unique to any particular locality. I think we have problems that are look very much alike in many cities and many communities throughout the country, and I'm really grateful that these issues are being raised and taken seriously and discussed, and that there are efforts to change the legislation, to change the governing laws, to litigate these issues seriously that will hopefully result in a shift in the way we do policing in the United States and in the way we respond to each other.
Attorney Duane Basco, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think there should be a national uniform policy, because as it currently stands right now, I don't believe officers are required to identify themselves by name and agencies, even when asked to. And it varies from locality to locality. So in order to, if we are really striving to engender trust in the community, then part of that has to go along with transparency.
Steve Schwarz, you want to add to that as well?
I guess I would just add that it's unfortunate that the abuse of social media, you know, results in something that makes things worse in the community for the citizens. I mean, obviously police officers need to be identified, and rather than take this kind of draconian action, I think we need to do something about social media harassment and impose some kind of liability to the social media to prevent the many, many abuses of social media that are going on, including, you know, what's recently happened in the Capitol. So, you know, I think that that's just a misguided effort. Certainly the police officers shouldn't be harassed. You know, I think that they have a tough job as it is, but I don't think this is the answer. And I think it goes in the wrong direction, obviously, of not allowing the public to understand who they are, who they're encountering. It's just wrong.
Okay. And James Nobles?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a delicate balance, and it's an issue that I hear officers talk about a lot. I mean, one of the things that's happened as a result of some of the disclosures here locally over the last year is that, you know, protesters are showing up at individual officers' homes. And, you know, they have young children, they have wives, they have families, they live in residential neighborhoods. And not to say that that's, you know, inappropriate. I mean, protesters can protest what they choose to do. But I think that the police officers, wrong or right, have a feeling that their information isn't protected. And in this day and age, when you can look up someone's name on the Internet and find out where they live very quickly, I think they do have at least some level of valid safety concern there. So I guess that's the other side of it. But it is certainly a complicated issue, and I understand the other side of the coin as well.
Okay, so before we wrap here, I would like to ask all of our guests, if there is one particular area of law, you know, as it pertains to law enforcement, whether it's immunity or otherwise, that you think the public tends to misunderstand and that you'd like to correct the record on. Because I've never met an attorney who thinks the lay public, especially the media, knows what we're talking about. James, this is a good chance for you to tell the media exactly where we get everything wrong, if you want. But on a more serious note, if there's something that you think is consistent that you think the public ought to be corrected on or understand, what is it?
So I think, you know, and this comes from 20 years of this type of practice, Evan, and as you know, both as a criminal defense attorney, but also a assistant district attorney for a period of time. What has always troubled me and what I've always found interesting is that after a trial or a grand jury presentation, you get some public backlash from people who never stepped foot in the courtroom, from people who did not hear one moment of eyewitness testimony or review one document in the case. And, you know, I think it's hard, and I know for a fact, having, you know, tried 20 homicide cases myself and being involved in a number of other cases, many, many other cases. You know, I've been in front of a lot of juries, and I know, especially in a case that has a lot of media attention and is high profile, it's a hard thing for jurors to do because they know that the community or portions of the community, probably on both sides, are going to criticize their decision-making without actually having, you know, looked at any of the evidence other than the snippets that are reported in the media. And I'm certainly not saying, you know, demonizing the media in any way. They can't report every word that comes through in testimony, but you can't make a judgment based on those very, very limited facts. But yet that's what, you know, society likes to do. And I feel bad for those jurors and grand jurors when that happens, and they have to say to themselves, if people just knew everything we knew, they probably would have decided what we decided.
Okay. But 30 to 40 seconds, Duane Basco, go ahead.
I would concur before a different reason that you need to do a lot more reading and not live off of the snippets, because when you look at it, even the declaration regarding excited delirium, which is not even a science, it's pseudoscience, and that was one of the excuses that was used and continues to be used in the death at the hands of police. But as far as the public is concerned, make sure that you educate yourself. Make sure that you read from reputable agencies and don't seclude yourself in silos.
Okay. Steve Schwartz, 30 seconds.
Okay, I won't talk long. I agree with both of the gentlemen that just spoke, and I think one of the problems though is that there's so little public trust in all institutions right now, and that includes juries. So, I think that there are a lot of juries that do a hard thing and they get a bad rap for sure. But I can understand why the public is skeptical, because a lot of people do think that the system is not fair, and it is not, it is weighted in the wrong direction. So we have to do a lot better in improving public trust of our institutions, and particularly our criminal and civil justice systems.
And Anna Marie Richton, we got to keep it tight. Go ahead.
I will. I just want to piggyback on what Mr. Basco said. The reason that the Bar Association is pulling together this program is so that people can educate themselves. I invite everybody to come. You'll learn something that you can use, I'm sure.
And you can come how? How can you be there on Zoom tomorrow, Anna Marie Richmond?
That's right. The WXXI has on their website links, as I understand it, to join the Bar Association by linking there.
You got it. We'll do that on our various platforms. I know you'd want anyone listening who's got an interest in these matters to attend. Good luck moderating, by the way, Anna Marie Richmond, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Duane Basco, attorney with Abrams Fensterman. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
James Nobles, a partner with Nobles and DeCarlis. Thank you, James.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Evan.
Stephen Schwarz, managing partner with Farachi Lang. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Evan.
And it's the Monroe County Bar Association Law Enforcement and Legal Community tomorrow, 5 to 6:30 on Zoom. We'll link it for you if you want to attend and learn more about what they're talking about here. Rob Braden, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson saying thank you, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.